Welcome. This is the Woodbury Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. We're glad that you tuned in, and if you'd like to know more about our church, you can find out all the information at woodburychurch.org. Or we'll see you some Sunday. Sundays at 10 a.m. Looking forward to it.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I hope you're having a good morning. I hope you're not bummed out by the snow. I'm sure some of you are probably looking forward to it. You're just like, this hasn't been a normal winter, but I'll take it every year. I want to start by saying Happy Me Day to you. You're welcome. Happy Me Day. Now, some of you are thinking, oh, no, I think this refers to somebody from Ireland hundreds of years ago. No. It's all about me, and it always has been. And you might be thinking, well, Patrick, you're not wearing green that I can see. And I'm like, yes, because I am Patrick. I define this. I can do what I want. It is my day. So if you're not wearing green, though, it's a free-for-all. I'm glad that you're here this morning. Just a couple things to remind you. Easter is coming. Easter is coming. And it's a day where people, regardless of their relationship with God, sometimes feel like, you know, maybe I'll reconnect. Maybe I'll check it out. Maybe I'll visit a church, and you might be the person that knows someone who is willing to do that. There was a study done recently that some crazy percent, it's something like 80% of people in the millennial category who do not go to church anywhere would go somewhere if they were invited. They're just looking for someone to go with, someone to say, hey, come with me. So Easter Sunday is an opportunity. It's really natural. Nobody's going to think you're a weirdo for inviting them to Easter Sunday. If they have children, then of course the Easter egg hunt is going to be fun as well. So just be keeping that in mind. 1946, a gentleman by the name of Thomas Cosby had a chicken farm. And this chicken farm happened to be right next to a military base that was converted into an Air Force base. And the planes happened to fly pretty low, sometimes as low as 70 feet. And it was scaring the chickens so much so that 150 of his chickens had a heart attack and died. So he went over to the military base and he said, you got to stop flying so low. You're scaring my chickens to death. The U.S. military said no. And so he sued them. He took them to court, and the case made its way through the appellate court, all the way to the Supreme Court, where his case was, listen, when I bought this property, the borders of my property, not only do I own the ground, I own what's underneath the ground, and I own what's above the ground, infinitely to the sky. It was just sort of a standard, there was no reason to dispute whether or not you had sky rights, whether or not you had air rights, and he said, I own everything, and the military is trespassing on my land. Well, the Supreme Court said, that's a little silly. We can't do that. But you do own up to about 500 feet above your property. So the next time you have a neighbor whose branch is hanging over your property, you can thank Thomas Cosby, the chicken farmer, as you chop it down without checking with him. Now, don't do that because that would probably be rude. But you own above your house. Isn't that interesting to think? You own up into the sky. Now, I'm getting a sense that none of you think that's as interesting as I think it is. You're like, okay, whatever. There's some people, you can actually sell your air rights. There's a whole thing. The reason I bring that up is because I'm fascinated by legal intricacies. I'm fascinated by the law and how it applies and how it works its way into everyday life. I don't know that we think about the law very much unless we're getting pulled over and we're like, uh-oh, did I check the speed limit in this little section? That doesn't seem reasonable. I doubt we think about the law a lot, but the law has a big role to play in your life. Now imagine you had, your whole life was literally, the details, the corners, the intricacies of your life were literally consumed by legal code. And then you start to begin to get an idea of what it was like to be an ancient Hebrew person. As we're in this series called Torah Together, remember, Torah means law, or it means instruction. And in the first five books of the Bible that you've been reading, some of you have come across these large chunks of what are essentially legal code. What do you do when your neighbor loses their ox? Do you have any obligation to help him find that ox? According to the legal code, you do. What happens if you accidentally knock somebody's eye out? Well, according to the legal code, they could take your eye if they wanted, depending on your intent. There's all kinds of things. But their lives, their ancient Hebrew life, was consumed with the details of the legal code that they had been given through the Torah. Now, of course, the Torah's stories and its legalities and more stories, and the stories are basically on repeat of how they couldn't keep the laws, but that's what's going on in those stories. So let me ask you a couple quick questions here. Accounting for repeats, how many specific laws are in the Torah? Accounting for repeats, how many specific laws are in the Torah? You can just take a guess if you don't know, it's fine. Wow, very good. 613 specific laws. There's a little bit of a debate on how you count two of them. So there's some groups that count 611 or 613, which means that somebody took their Bible, took their Torah, went through and was like one. Oh, that's a repeat. Okay. One, two, and then they got to 613. That's wild. 613. Does that feel like a lot of rules to have to keep? You know, it is nowhere near what the legal code of the federal government is. You're talking hundreds of thousands of laws. And we're kind of funny about the Old Testament. Ah, it's just a bunch of stuffy laws. It's nothing compared to what people have to navigate. Even tax code, even the U.S. tax code has more laws than the Old Testament Torah. And so I think we're kind of wimps when it comes to the Bible sometimes. It's not that big of a deal. 613 feels like a lot, but it's not that big of a deal. So we're in the book of Deuteronomy. Just real quick, just for those of you who like to show off, how many of you have finished the reading plan? You're all the way through all five books. Raise your hands if you finished the reading plan. We got one. I know we got more than one because I follow you on the Bible app and you're just not willing to admit it here this morning. Okay, we have one who's willing to admit it right over here. And I just actually finished this morning as well. So gold star, right, for me and Travis. So we finished the book of Deuteronomy. Does anybody know what Deuteronomy means in the Greek? What is Deuteronomy Greek for? Oh, see, I don't know if you can hear him, but that's my father who answered correctly, and he said, I told you this last week, by the way, but he said second law, which means you have some law in Genesis, not a whole lot. You have quite a bit in the second half of Exodus. You got a lot in Leviticus, a lot in Numbers. And then in Deuteronomy, they're like, you know what? We're just going to give the law again. And we're going to call the book second law. We're going to base it off the Greek title of the book. Second law. Why do we have a second law? 613 laws are hard to miss. And I know some of you are like, uh-oh, Patrick, are we about to talk about laws? Is that what this is about? If I had known and it was snowing, I probably would have stayed home or gone somewhere else. We're going to talk about laws. And you're here, so you're stuck. But I actually think this is going to be incredibly beneficial because I think the law has something to say to you, and it has something to do with your life right now as you sit in these chairs and as you go about your day-to-day and tomorrow and the coming week. 613 laws are hard to miss. Some of the laws are odd. They're strange. They're strange laws. They are pretty weird. If you've read through there, there's some food laws, and you're just like, I don't understand why we can't eat bats and pork, but somehow gazelle is okay. I've never ordered gazelle off a menu. There is a law in Deuteronomy, if you're kind of current on the reading, about a very inappropriate way for a wife to stop a fight between her husband and another man. It's pretty wild. And if you're reading that, you're like, why is that in there? Was that a problem for somebody? Some of the laws are awesome. The Sabbath year law is amazing. Every 7 years, they weren't supposed to do any tilling of the soil, any planting, any sowing. They were just supposed to just feast off the bounty of the land that God would provide. That's a cool law. I like that. Don't plow, forgive debt. There's laws like in chapter 24 to help refugees and widows and the fatherless that are just awesome. But there's certainly troubling laws too, as you read through there. There's some that are very not politically correct, very much so. There are some that appear backward and even regressive to us. And it is hard to discern how do those laws reflect the character of God or what God desires to build in people. So reading these laws lead us with questions. And even if you haven't read any of the laws, even if this is your first Sunday, you've had these questions as someone who's been exposed to the Bible, particularly the Hebrew Bible that has all these laws. So it leaves us with questions. Number one, how do we explain problematic laws? What does it mean that people who are born with some genetic defect are excluded from worship? That doesn't sound very good. That sounds problematic to us. Why did some laws change? Why did God say, don't do this? And in the New Testament, he was like, it's fine. No big deal. Why did it change? Why was it wrong to wear clothes made of two different types of fabric, but then none of you checked the labels on your clothes this morning to make sure, I hope it's just linen, I hope it's just wool, because I don't want to make God mad as I go worship him today. Why did that change? Why do people basically ignore one of the Ten Commandments today? Why do we ignore that? Does anybody know the one we ignore today? We keep sort of nine of them, or at least we think we should keep nine of them, but there's one we don't. Does anybody know? Yeah, we don't keep the Sabbath. Yeah, that was yesterday, and I'm assuming some of you made fires and did some work and did some things that the Old Testament, the Hebrew law, prescribed not to do. And then things get really dicey when the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, address modern cultural landmines. So as you read through there, you notice things about same-sex relationships. And some point to the Torah, Christians point to the Torah, and they look at, well, what about these verses in Leviticus? See, God says it's wrong. Let's anchor our truth right there in Leviticus. And then other people respond and say, but hey, as you're telling me that you're picking and choosing because you're pointing to that law, but you're eating a pork hot dog, you're wearing fabrics of mixed clothes, how do we navigate that? How do we work through those kinds of distinctions? The laws in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, can be like a big crack in the sidewalk. Some people hop right over it, no problem. They're like, no, I love Jesus. I don't know, that stuff doesn't really make sense, but I don't let it bother me. Someday I'll get to heaven and I'll ask Jesus all about it. They're just like, no big deal. Other people, it weighs them down, and they're tremendously bothered by the things that they read in the laws. They eventually, some people come to conclusions like, I don't know that I can believe in a God who would command something like that. So what do we do? What do we do with these Hebrew Bible laws? What do we do with them? There's three bad options that are pretty popular in varying degrees of popularity. One bad option is to keep them. That's a bad option. You've probably run into, met people who keep or try to keep almost all of the Old Testament laws. There's a few they don't, like they don't offer sacrifices at the temple too often. But their theory is, hey, it's in the Bible, Jesus kept them. And so there's churches that gather on Saturday, which is the traditional Sabbath, instead of Sunday. Now, there's people you probably know that won't eat pepperoni pizza because it's made out of pork, or people who won't eat hot dogs. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. There's others who go through, and this is by far the most popular one. This is probably what a lot of people do. And this is by far, when I was studying for this topic, by far the most popular answer from Bible religious leaders and teachers is they say, well, we keep the good ones. So we sort through the Bible and we find the ones that we like and we think are good and make sense to us and we keep those. So, for example, help your neighbor with his lost donkey. We're like, yeah, that's nice. Next time my neighbor loses their donkey, I'll help him. We'll keep that one. But burn all the plunder of conquered villages? Pass. I won't do that one. And in preparation for this, I found that this was the most common approach, even among really well-known teachers and church leaders. And I realize why this is a popular approach, because they're worried about, like, but there's all these beautiful truths contained in the Hebrew Bible. We don't want to lose them. We don't want anybody to assume that we should just dismiss them, and that's not what I'm advocating for at all. But there's these beautiful truths, and I don't want to lose them, so let's just pick and choose the ones that we think we should maintain. But the problem is that one of the laws repeated throughout the Torah is that you can't add to or take away from the laws. It's a package deal. You either keep them all or you ignore them all, according to the Torah. So how do we navigate that? And then I think the final option for a lot of us is we just keep quiet. When somebody comes up to us and says, hey, why don't you do this, or how do you think about this? We're just like, I don't know. I'll email Patrick and ask him, and you can talk to him. But so we kind of stick to Psalm 23, we read the Proverbs, and then the New Testament. And anytime questions come up, we're like, I don't know. I don't like to think about that. So how should we approach the Torah? How should Christians approach specifically the laws of the Torah? So let me ask this in a few different ways. Let me ask this question. Are Christians required to keep the expectations of the Old Covenant law, the Hebrew law, the Old Testament? Let me see if I can put this in a short sentence. No, we're not required to keep the Old Covenant. And we'll talk about that. I'll give you some verses about that in a second. Okay, but there are some good laws in there, Patrick. There are some good things that we want to maintain. So which of the 613 laws should we pull out and keep and try to maintain and try to make part of our daily lives? Which of the 613? None of them. And you're like, Patrick, I'm not sure that I agree with that. Hang on. Buckle yourselves in. Well, what about the obviously good ones, Patrick? What about the ones like the Ten Commandments that do not murder, do not covet, do not bear false witness? What about those? Should we keep those? Nope. Now, some of you are like, okay, now I know you're messing with me because you're just telling me that I can just go out here and murder someone. The next time I don't like how the person in front of me is driving, I have free license. No, hang on. But in terms of our relationship with God, in terms of our connection to who God is and what he's calling for us, we are not required to keep the expectations of the old covenant. And it's really important that we understand that. That may feel like an abstract idea, but it's incredibly important that we understand that. Not because of what the old law said or that it wasn't good or that it wasn't perfect or that it wouldn't produce wonderful results, but because we were unable to. Now, some of you are hearing me say, oh, so we could just throw out the Old Testament? We can throw out the Torah? We can throw out the first two-thirds of our Bibles? Absolutely not. In fact, I think it's more valuable, more important than ever. The value of reading through these first five books has been tremendous. It's been incredible. It's been convicting. It's been transformative. But maybe not for the reasons we always think so. So if you're confused, I understand. People in the first century were confused too. It's a huge topic in the New Testament, by the way. It's a huge point of contention. Most of the letters in your New Testament either orbit around this central idea or central question, or they at least address it. Sammy Hagar. I guess this song came out while I was still alive, but he has this song saying, the chorus of which is, I can't drive 55. You ever heard that song? I can't drive 55. How many of you woke up and had on your bingo card, we were going to see a picture of Sammy Hagar in church this morning? I can't drive 55. I've never understood that song. I've thought, like, okay, Sammy Hagar, are you driving an old car that just can't get that fast? Is that the problem? Or is it rush hour and traffic's really slow? It's never really made sense. The lyrics are him complaining about wanting to drive faster than 55 on the interstate, and he can't. And I hear that song, and I'm like, do it. What's stopping you from driving 55? The police aren't going to pull you over. What's the problem? What's going on, Sammy Hagar, that you can't? I never listened to the lyrics of it. I just, you know, the chorus of it. Why can't you drive 55? Well, this is what I didn't know. And if you are older than me here, you do know this, that in 1974, Congress passed a bill called the Emergency Highway Energy Conservation Act, which stated that no interstate road could have a speed limit higher than 55. Did you know that?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a certain generational line here that did know that, and some of us did not. So in many cases, this is about conserving energy, in many cases, the speed limit was lowered to 55 in certain stretches. So, Sammy Hagar, he was driving in upstate New York, he was doing 62 and a 55, he got a ticket, and it made him so mad, he wrote a song about it. The spirit in me cannot drive 55, and he made lots of money, and eventually was selected as the lead singer of Van Halen because his notoriety based on this song, based on the fact that he did not want to keep the speed limit. Now, if you don't know who Sammy Hagar is, whatever, it doesn't matter. The funny thing is the federal speed limit was upped to 65 in 1987, but they're still playing this song on the radio. So it didn't really make sense to me. And you're like, Sammy, it's a new era. You can drive 55. You're allowed to now, man. And now it's even higher than that. In 1994, they raised it again. The New Testament authors are not subtle about the topic of Christians related to the law. All these verses, and these are just a few selected from many more, in some cases even stories like Acts chapter 15, if you would like to read that, are all about, hey, we're redeemed from the law. We're not bound to the law. We're not obligated to the law. The entire book of Galatians and the entire book of Hebrews are essentially about this question, about how do Christians relate to it. So much of the New Testament is Paul coming along and saying, good news, everybody. You can drive 70 miles an hour. The laws have changed. Things are different now. And then there's this other group of people coming in saying, no. 55, that's the way it's been for me. That was the way I grew up. That was the way my parents grew up. Nobody really needs to get anywhere faster than 55 miles an hour. Anyway, that's the way it should be. I don't want to hear any of this crazy talk about doing faster than 55. And there was this huge conflict in the New Testament. And Paul and other authors wrote again and again and again about, listen, you have to understand our relationship with the old covenant. We are not bound by it. We are set free from it. Look at what it says in Hebrews chapter 8. Verse 7, for if there had been nothing wrong with the first covenant, this is really important, because there's not anything wrong with the covenant in terms of what God was expecting from people. But look what he says, there would be no place to have been sought for another, but God found fault with people. Yeah. People were like, I can't drive 55, God. I can't do it. I cannot keep your expectations. And of course, they didn't say that. They just kept agreeing to God, like, we'll do it, we'll do it, we'll do it. And then they didn't do it. But look at what he says. And he begins to quote Jeremiah here in Hebrews. So this is Jeremiah prophesying that things were going to change in the future. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people. Not because the old covenant is bad, but because people are bad. That's part of the point of the Torah, is you get a set of laws, the people say we will do it, and then the people do not do it. Repeat, 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 repeat. They cannot do it. Why is that? I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make. I will establish with the people of Israel. After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer, this is so interesting, no longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, know the Lord, because they will all know me from the least of them to the greatest. For I will forgive their wickedness. This is so good. If you weren't in class today, you should ask Bruce what he taught about. For I will forgive their wickedness. I will remember their sins no more. But look how he wraps up that section of prophecy. This is the author of Hebrews. By calling this covenant new, he has made the first one obsolete, and what is obsolete and outdated will soon disappear. And that was the truth. The Hebrew temple, where they were bringing sacrifices daily to offer to God, was going to be destroyed. It was destroyed 70 AD. It hasn't been rebuilt since, and it won't be rebuilt, by the way. Despite what you may have heard in some late night, televangelists say, it's obsolete. Sammy, if you're still driving 55, man, that's on you. That's on you, because the new covenant is here. Now, what are some healthy, helpful ways of thinking about? Because the Hebrew covenant, it's a beautiful thing. It is a beautiful thing. And to dismiss it, to ignore it, would be at our own peril. It contains wonderful truths. But how, given that we are in a new covenant, how should we interact with it? And I just want to essentially walk through this statement briefly. For us, the Torah, the first five books of the Old Bible, the Old Covenant. By the way, the word Torah means law, and because there was so much law, they just called the first five books of the Bible law. The Torah is designed to shape us and to break us and to lead us to Jesus. The Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the laws, the expectations, they're designed to shape us, they're designed to break us, and they're designed to lead us to Jesus. I'm going to walk through each of those concepts, shape, break, and lead us to Jesus. The Torah is designed to shape us. Imagine one of your kids did this. I know they never would, but imagine one of your kids came to you and said, excuse me, Mom, excuse me, Dad, which of the family rules do you really want me to keep? Which of the expectations that you have established for me and my siblings is really important? If they asked you that, you'd be like, what would you say? Exactly. You'd say all of them. Or how about if you're sitting in employee orientation and a person from HR is going over the behavior policies of the company and you say, which of these policies are really most important? What would the HR employee say? All of them. Keep all of them. It's concerning that you would even ask that. Why are you asking? But it's strange then in Matthew 22, verse 35, one of them, an expert in the Torah, an expert, somebody who should know, tested Jesus with this question, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the Torah?" An expert of the Torah, which is the greatest commandment? Isn't that a strange question? Why, Jesus, what should Jesus' answer be? All of them. They're all good. They're all perfect. They're all inspired. Why are you asking me which is the greatest commandment? That's strange. So what's especially strange is that's not how Jesus answers. Instead, he quotes Deuteronomy and he says, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." And the expert in the law was like, "Yeah, that's right." Because he was testing him. He knew what the answer was. Verse 39, "And the second is like it." In fact, the second is so like it that you can't keep the first without keeping the second. "Love your neighbor as yourself." Now, go back one slide. We're jumped ahead one there. Pretend you didn't see that, because that's going to be important in a second. Jesus quotes Deuteronomy. The teacher knew the answer. And Jesus says something surprising. And I just don't, to us, it seems shocking. I don't think it would have been to the people to whom he was speaking. But he literally says that all the law and all the prophets, so everything that you read in the first two-thirds of your Bible are really only pointing to these ideas, to love God and love your neighbor. Every strange law, every odd rule, every weird thing that was commanded was designed to encourage love of God and love of neighbor. That's amazing. It was all an expression of love toward God or act of love toward a neighbor. Now, there's contextual things that they were required to do that are different than us, but that's what they were getting at. That's what they were getting at. Because over the centuries, Hebrew people, as they engaged with the Torah, they started to realize, oh, some of those very literal commands seem to have undergirding principles under them. So, for example, Deuteronomy 22 says, "If you see your fellow Israelite's ox or sheep straying, do not ignore it, but take it back to its owner." It's very specific, right? Now, if you are a teenage Hebrew person and you're looking for loopholes in the law, you might say, well, I don't have to help my neighbor with their chicken. I don't have to help them with their goat because it doesn't mention chickens and it doesn't mention goats. I can ignore those. But smart people were like, I think you're missing the spirit of what God is trying to do here. In fact, I think God is trying to say, hey, help your neighbor, because it probably applies to chickens and goats too, and you should probably watch out for your neighbor in general. And then eventually they came to the conclusion, you know, it really seems like God is wanting us to watch out for our neighbors kind of as ourselves. Like, we should love our neighbors as ourselves. And then Jesus comes along and says that very specifically. And they realize that these underlying expectations of the law could apply in new and unexpected ways. That's really important. Now, the question for me is, well, why didn't God just say that from the beginning? Why didn't he just say at the beginning of the Bible, love God, love neighbor, we don't need five books here, just love God, love neighbor. Just, that's all. That's what you need to do. Why didn't he do that? Well, I know that what I would have done with the vagueness, this is just speculation, but when my children were toddlers, I couldn't just go to Avery, little three-year-old Avery, and say, Avery, hey, clean your room. And then come back 2 hours later and expect anything really to have happened, right? It's very different now. But when they're little, you walk them through it, right? You walk them through step by step, right? Anybody sing the Barney song with them? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to sing it because I don't want to ruin your day, but yeah. And you're like, yeah, no, yeah, dirty clothes, they go in the hamper. Oh, no, banana peels, they don't go in the hamper. And you just walk them through every detail. In theory, I should be able to say, Avery, clean your room now and expect it generally to happen. But I should be able to expect that. Because every time I say, Avery, put away your toys, when she's a toddler, I'm saying, clean your room. Avery, make your bed, clean your room. Avery, vacuum the carpet. I don't know if toddlers can do that, but clean your room. Every specific detail of what I'm asking her is to accomplish this larger goal. And now that she is older, I can just say, hey, clean your room. I don't need to give the details of the rules. So we're on the same page. The Torah, if we engage with it, if we wrestle with it, if we read it and we learn it, will shape us. It is designed to shape us. But it's also designed to break us. When we were going through the saga of my youngest son's four broken arms in the span of however many years, we kind of got into this sad little routine at the orthopedic doctor. So you'd go to the doctor, you'd get an x-ray, they would set the bone, they would splint it, you'd come back later, they would x-ray it again, they would cast it. Now, I knew the routine, and aside from the actual break, and I'm not going to show you any pictures, some of you are like, you're gearing up for it, I could tell. Aside from the actual broken bone, my least favorite part of the whole routine were the x-rays. Because he would have to go into a little room, and they would have to kind of manipulate his arm so they could get the right angle to take the right pictures. And we'd done it so many times, I didn't need the x-ray technician to tell me. I knew to go stand behind the lead-lined wall while poor little Liam is by himself holding this arm in an awkward way because it's got this break, you know, just miserable, you know, and you want to be there, you want to comfort him, but whatever, you don't want to get cancer. So you're standing over there, and he's by himself. One time, the lady had him come in, and, you know, sometimes it's kind of awkward, and, you know, it's painful, right? I mean, it's a broken arm. It's painful. And so they're manipulating him, and they're just getting him just to the right angle, and they're like, okay, go stand over here. And I think poor Liam is reliving this. Sorry, buddy. And we're standing behind the lead-lined wall, and the x-ray tech notices something that I don't. And it was one of the most unbelievable, like, superhero moves I'd ever seen. She sprinted from where we were across the room because Liam went white, because it's painful, manipulating that, went white, his eyes rolled back up in his head, and he was on this little stool, and he started to go. And this lady, athlete of the year, sprinted over there, and I might be exaggerating in my memory, but I don't think so. You probably don't remember because you were passed out. She sprinted over there, and in my memory, she dove on the ground and, like, caught him before he hit the ground. It was unbelievable. I was just, like, in shock. I didn't even know what was going on, and she was acting like, you know, superhero out there. It was really cool. But the whole x-ray thing just was painful. It was awful, but it was necessary because the x-ray told us where the problems were so that the doctors could deal with it. But here's what's crucial. The x-ray can't fix the problem. It can only point to the problem. And this is a good way for us to think about the Hebrew Bible. It doesn't fix the problem, but it can point to the problem in us. There has to be a solution, but it can certainly reveal the problem. Look at what Romans chapter 3, verse 20 says. Paul writes, therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by the works of the law. You cannot do it. You cannot be good enough. But rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. Here's the problem with society. I sound like one of those retired guys that meets at McDonald's to drink coffee with his buddies. Here's the problem with society. But it's true. It always has been. Humans are broken, and we can hardly bring ourselves to believe it. Yeah. That's the problem with society. Yeah. Now, some of you are like, well, compared to people on death row, I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing all right. Or other people are saying, well, listen, my friends tell me I'm really nice. My mommy said I was a good boy. According to, maybe some of you are like, well, listen, according to the constantly shifting cultural standards, I support the right causes. I always thumbs up the right thing on social media. So I'm doing pretty good. I'm not broken, Patrick. I'm not a bad person. By all these subjective standards that I've created, I'm doing just fine. But what if there were an objective good person test? What if there were some quiz you could subject yourself to that really revealed whether or not you were a good person? That would be amazing, right? Well, what about murder? Do you ever murder anybody? I was preaching somewhere. It was deep south Louisiana. I was preaching somewhere, and I kind of posed a question like this. You know, my expectation is that everybody in the audience would be like, no, I've never murdered anybody, right? Come to find out later, there was a gentleman in the audience that had just gotten out of prison for murder. So I don't always assume. Maybe somebody here is murdered, and maybe you've got some deep, dark secret in the back of your mind or in your basement. But I'm assuming here that nobody Nobody's murdered. And so you're like, I'm doing good, right? So far, so good on this quiz. Well, Jesus came along and said, oh, wait. Actually, what the old covenant was trying to get to was the hate in your heart. Have you ever hated anybody? Oh, okay. Well, okay. All right. So, fine. I'm not doing good there. How about lust? Have you ever lusted after anyone or anything? Well, not when anyone's looking and maybe only late at night on online. Do you ever lie? Well, rarely. Not very often, unless I'm in a real pickle or I think I might hurt someone's feelings. Do you honor your parents? Well, yeah. Well, I mean, unless they're doing something dumb or I disagree with them, unless they voted for somebody I didn't like, yeah, but otherwise, sure. But if you work through the expectations of the Hebrew law, you'll discover that you're not quite the person you thought you were by some objective measure. By our subjective standards, sure, we're great because we can dismiss all that stuff. We can be like, well, hey, I got about 70% on that test. That's not very good. The law is an x-ray revealing objective truth about our hearts. So here's what we do is we say, okay, so sometimes I lie, sometimes I hate, sometimes I lust, sometimes I dishonor loved ones, sometimes I dismiss the marginalized, but it's okay because my mom said I was a nice boy, right? No. By an objective standard, by what God has revealed, inspired in Scripture, we're broken, and we have a hard time admitting that. Yep. The Torah is designed to shape us, but it's also designed to break us. But then, so importantly, designed to lead us to Jesus. When I worked for a pool company, this is years ago, I ended up interacting with some pretty wealthy people. You don't have to be wealthy to have a pool, but wealthy people have pools, right? And one family I interacted with, they just kind of spoke about these things casually, and it was just mind-blowing to me. But they didn't want their kids to go to public school, which, okay, I understand. That's a debate parents have. But they didn't think the private schools were good enough for their kids either. I'm like, well, it's a debate parents have. But they didn't think they were capable of homeschooling. And I'm like, you're really running out of options here. I don't know what you're going to do. And they said that they had hired a teacher for just their children. And this teacher was also functioned as a nanny. Now, I had no idea this existed in today's age. I have seen The Sound of Music, and I know what a governess is, but there are people today who still have governesses, or governors, I guess, I don't know. Anyway, they had hired a person to be like to bring private school to their children in their home. And that's that person's whole job. And they were talking about how much they paid them. And I was like, I got to get out of the pool business. That sounds really good. Galatians chapter 3, verse 24 says, the law was our guardian. And the reason I'm telling you that story is because there just doesn't exist really in English a good word to describe this, but you could translate it, the law was our governess, or the law was our governor. The law was this person that had been hired to be in our home and to teach us and guide us and mold us and shape us until Christ came, that we might be justified by faith. Now that faith has come, we have graduated, and we are no longer under that guardian. Some of your translations will say tutor, or even the old King James says schoolmaster. This word guardian is unique. It's only used three times and twice in this verse. But what Paul is saying is you graduated. Congratulations. You have been led, you've been shaped, you've been broken by the law, and you've graduated. You ever watch a TV show set in like the Middle Ages? And thought, man, I am grateful for modern dentistry. You know what I mean? Or, wow, I can't, or like a war movie where they've got to amputate, but there's no anesthesia, so they just put a stick in the poor guy's mouth. Like, I'm so grateful that I can be knocked out for any minor procedures today's day and age. I'm not entirely sure I could survive in a different era. Some of you are tough and think you could do that, but I'm not sure I could survive without air conditioning and indoor plumbing. Even in Minnesota, have you thought about maybe some of you who are longtime Minnesotans, your great-grandparents, your great-great-grandparents, if you had to use the restroom in the middle of the night, in the winter, during a blizzard? No way. I am glad I am born in the era I was born in. I have never once read through the Torah. I've never once read through the Old Testament without having this thought. Wow. I am really grateful for Jesus. I'm really grateful for Jesus. I read through those laws and I'm like, I don't know if I could do it. I'm so grateful. If for Jesus. Sometimes I can pretend that I have it all together, but other times, if I give it about 2 seconds of thought, I'm grateful. I'm grateful that Jesus has fulfilled the law for us, Matthew chapter 5. In John chapter 1, we're going to wrap up with this. I'm going to ask the praise team to go ahead and come back up. We're going to sing about the goodness of God. But in John chapter 1, verse 5, as they were being introduced to Jesus, they were shaped and steeped and familiar with the Hebrew law. But as Philip found Nathanael, he said, "Hey, we found the one. We found the one that Moses has been writing about." And I bet some of you are reading those Old Testament laws, those Old Testament expectations, you're like, I didn't see Jesus' name in there anywhere. But there's constant hints, constant undertones that there's something coming, that God wants us to love him and love neighbor, and he knows we're going to fall short. He knows we're not going to be able to make it, and he knows that guilt is going to be overwhelmingly burdensome. But there is a way forward. We have found the one that Moses wrote about. Let's stand together and sing as we close out.